It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's what could be your next favorite Asian cuisine. Now, this one's bolder than its neighbors. Think barbecue and kimchi. We talk Korean, how to order out and how to cook in, with Cecilia Hae-Jin Lee, author of Eating Korean. Well, for the Stearns, it's a new definition of open 24/7. At Lang's Cafe in Pipestone, Minnesota, they dropped their door keys in the cement years ago. Christopher Kimball of Cooks Illustrated has freezing tips for summer gems. We get professional kitchen tricks from the author of Chef's Secrets. Then it's dining in high style for a low price at the great wine bars of New York City. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Now sit up straight, Kate. It's time to eat, Pete. Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Get with the gravy, Davy.
Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Try a tomato, Plato. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste the bologna, Tony.
Everybody eats when they come to my house.
I fix your favorite dishes, hoping this good food fills you. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills you. Pass me a pancake mandrake. Sample a taco paco. Have an hors d'oeuvre, Irby.
Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Hannah, Davy, Tommy, Dora, Mandrake.
Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Pasta, Fazula, Cholula. Oh, do have a bagel, Fagel. Now don't be so bashful, Nashville.
Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Hey, this is a party, Marty. You get the cherry, Jerry. Now look, don't be so picky, Mickey.
Everybody eats when they come to my house.
All of my friends are welcome. Now, don't make me nag ya, mag ya. Eat the tables, the chairs, the napkins, who cares? Eat all my things if they gag ya. Have a frittata lata. Nibble a kibble, Sybil. Chili con carne for Barney.
Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Face, Busta, Cher, Chops, Thump. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Steak, cake, pie, side, juice, root, tart, bart. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Next Friday night, you're all invited to dance from 8 to 3. All the fishies in the sea are having a ball. It's some affair, they'll all be there from the herring to the whale. They'll turn out to shake a scale in Neptune's hall. Come along and follow me to the bottom of the sea. We'll join in the jamboree at the codfish ball. Lobsters dancing in a row, shuffle off to Buffalo. Jellyfish sway to and fro at the codfish ball. Finn and Hattie lead the eels through an Irish reel. The catfish is a dancing man, but he can't can like the sardine can. Tunas trucking left and right, snappers tapping, what a night. There won't be a hook in sight at the codfish ball. Octopus and albacore, 50 miles away from shore, tango cross the ocean floor at the codfish ball. Minnows dance the minuet, barracudas pirouette, while the stingray plays his clarinet at the codfish ball. Scottish salmon form a ring and dance the Highland fling.
The music's hot, so the lark starts trot, and the halibut is the jitterbug king. Sing it with me now.
Come along and follow me to the bottom of the sea. We'll join in the jamboree at the cottage ball. Lobsters dancing in a row, a shuffle off to Buffalo. Jellyfish sway to and fro at the cockfish ball.
Finn and Hattie lead the eels through an Irish reel. The catfish is a dancing man, but he can't, like the sardine can.
Tuna trucking left and right, snappers tapping, what a night! There won't be a hook in sight at the cockfish ball.
At the codfish ball. At the codfish ball. Da, 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 da.
Yeah. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's Korean food, and if you haven't tried it, you should. It's bold, it's spicy, and it's served in a way that you get to play with all kinds of flavor combinations. Well, food writer Cecilia Hae-Jin Lee gives us the essentials. Her book is Eating Korean, From Barbecue to Kimchi, Recipes from My Home. Then we've got the skinny on freezing summer's overload with the chief of PBS's America's Test Kitchen, Christopher Kimball. Now, this is a guy who can actually see the back of his freezer. Francine Marukian talks chef's secrets, like sanding clams by running water over a spoon. We've got bargains at New York City's wine bars, a cultural feminist take on Tupperware, and as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now you can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, we love a restaurant that never closes. And that has been the case at Lang's Cafe in Pipestone, Minnesota for the last 40 years. When they remodeled the place 40 years ago, they dropped the keys into wet cement and put doors on the place that had no locks whatsoever. So 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, Lang's Cafe is open and serving some pretty darn good food.
What kinds of stuff do they do?
Well, can I jump to the end just because this is such a fabulous thing?
Oh, yes.
Minnesota is really home of the world's best sour cream raisin pie. On a 1 to 10 scale, Lang's is a 10. And I can tell you that it makes me very happy that this place never closes, because should I be in the area and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and I get a Jones for some sour cream raisin pie, I know where to go. And I love that.
In fact, we went there for breakfast on our first visit, and we had this absolutely stupendous caramel roll for breakfast. It was about it seemed like it was 4 by 4 by 4 inches, like a plate size caramel roll.
It was 4 by 4 by 4.
And as we finished this caramel roll, we happened to notice some pies coming out of the kitchen. The sour cream raisin pie was still slightly warm, and the waitress apologized to us for that fact. But of course, we had to follow our caramel rolls by sour cream raisin pie. So the fact that it was still slightly warm didn't hurt how delicious it was.
Well, when you're having it as a main course, it's nice having it a little warm.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this is not a place for, don't go here after your gastric bypass. I mean, do not, this is not a place for light dining, because the main thing they serve for lunch is a hot beef sandwich. Being Midwesterners, you obviously know what this is.
Right, but I think you better describe it for the rest of the world.
Okay, it's not just hot roast beef. I mean, for years, Jane and I would see hot beef on the menus of the upper Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota primarily. We'd say, who cares? Hot beef isn't that interesting. Finally, somebody clued us in to the fact that this was as precious to the people of that region as barbecue is to North Carolinians.
Mm-hmm.
Hot beef is like It's kind of like pot roast. It's like chunky pieces of beef, you know, so tender that if you just touch them with your fork, they kind of fall into shreds in natural kind of gravy. If you get it as in sandwich form, which I like, the beef is piled on a couple pieces of nice, absorbent white bread, topped with gravy and sided by a volcano of mashed potatoes.
I have seen the mashed potatoes many times served on top of the whole thing, not on the side. So it's sort of like what in this neck of the woods in Connecticut, we would call a hot roast beef sandwich, but with this big blob of mashed potatoes on top of it. Well, which really sets you up very well for a 4x4x4 caramel roll and a big piece of sour cream raisin pie.
I think they do have salad on the menu.
Is this sort of like the local cafe?
Yes.
That's the feel of it. I mean, it's you know, where it is on Route 23 is kind of a, it's not a major road, but it's a road that a lot of people travel. So I think in addition to being a kind of town cafe for Pipestone, Minnesota, it's also a place that a lot of travelers stop, hence the 24-hour-a-day policy.
And sour cream raisin pie, if you want to be taken as a local, call it SCR. You don't have to say the long
form. Is that
form.
True? I've never heard that. I think Jane is making this up so she gets all the sour cream raisin pie for herself.
So, well, now, so they have no idea what you're talking about, and they ignore you.
Exactly. I can see all these people going in and saying, could I have an SCR, and everybody looking at them blankly. But Jane, you may have started a new trend. Hey, guys, thanks.
Goodbye, Len.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern have updated their classic guide, Road Food. Now, you can hear them here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week, we get you a fast worknight supper recipe along with shopping and technique tips. By the way, this week's recipe is grilled scampi with double garlic aioli. Weeknight Kitchen is free, guys, so sign up, splendidtable.org. Now, I think of Cook's Illustrated magazine as the consumer reports of food and cooking. They take no advertising, they are relentless testers, and they don't hold back an opinion. Cook's creator and editor-in-chief is Christopher Kimball, a.k.a. the Kitchen Detective. Christopher, welcome back.
My great pleasure to be here.
You know, the farmers markets are going nuts right now, and we've got all these vegetables and all this produce, and we're going to want to put it away in the freezer. So what I'd like to do, could you take us through a freezer primer? How do you use this thing?
Well, first of all, most Americans think potatoes is the only vegetable. But for those of us who actually eat other vegetables...
That was snide. Now, come on.
But it's true. Our readers at Cook's always say they love vegetables, but they actually don't eat them. But anyway, we found a number of things. First of all, the freezer temperature is obviously key. And it should be zero, not 5 or 10. It turns out, for example, if you have one of those canister ice cream freezers that need to be in there for a few hours... It isn't going to work if it's 10 or 12 degrees. So you really need to find out how cold your freezer is. And you can buy one of those inexpensive freezer thermometers to find out. Reasons why a freezer may not be cold enough would be you stuff it full of things so there's no airflow. There has to be airflow. You can't just stack everything up.
What an interesting idea.
I know. Isn't that, this is a very complex concept. But it's not rocket science, but there has to be airflow. And, in fact, you don't want to block... the vent in the back of the freezer as well.
Come on. Now, Chris, when was the last time you saw your air vent?
I was 10, which I'm not telling you how long ago that was. It was in my mother's early 1950s.
All right, but I have to accept what you're saying because it does make sense. It can't be cold unless the cold air can get around the food, right?
Yeah, and you can also actually buy, removable shelving and put that in the freezer to get things separated so there's airflow. Mm-hmm. So instead of stacking everything up, you can throw one of those wire racks in and that'll help. But the vent in the back wall does need to be visually apparent when you open the door. Now, the other thing is, just like a refrigerator, the warmest spot is on the door. So stuff that you're not going to keep too long in the freezer, maybe nuts or butter, other things, you will keep that in the door. But in the back, inside, is where the coldest spot is. So stuff you're going to hold for months should probably go there.
So what about packing for the freezer?
Well, there's a general rule, which is double wrap. Almost everything we do is double wrap. So you might take plastic wrap first and put that around the food, or foil in the case of bread, and then throw that into a Ziploc bag and get all the air out and seal it. So double wrapping is the rule for that. We also just tested last week an apple pie, and we found that if you froze the filling separately from the dough and then thawed them both out and finished making the pie, that was much better than freezing a whole pie, for example.
And the apples don't get mushy in the freezing?
Yeah, they do. They have high water content. Anything with a lot of water content is always somewhat problematic. But we had readers actually send in some pretty good quick tips. The one I love is this bacon storage freezing method, which is you take the leftover bacon, and instead of putting the slab or half a slab back in the freezer,
right,
you roll up individual pieces, rashers, just roll them up and throw them in a plastic bag so you can take out one at a time or three at a time, just what you want.
That's like the tomato paste thing where you dollop like tablespoons of it onto a piece of wax paper or something, freeze it, and then throw that into the plastic
bag.
That
works. Of course, tomato paste now, our favorite is in a tube, which gets around the problem.
Yeah.
Chipotle chilies, which you buy in cans, we can pull the same stunt by putting them out on parchment paper and freezing them.
Mm-hmm.
Cookie dough, you can use the same trick, you know, balls of cookie dough, freeze them on parchment. When they're frozen, put them into a container and separate them with parchment paper layers. And also, another trick I found is with ice cube trays.
Right.
You can freeze pesto or herbs with water, for example, and that's a good way to keep herbs for a long time.
How long can you keep some of this stuff?
Pesto seems to keep pretty well. Bread actually keeps fairly well. Meat will store for a few months. The problem with the freezer is it tends to dehydrate food over time. The double wrapping helps, but you're going to find the moisture content goes down.
What about vegetables? Because that's a big thing now that we're seeing so many greens and veggies in the market. We want to keep them for winter.
Well, certain things you can just freeze. For example, in the summer, blueberries, there's about 3 weeks where we have thousands of blueberries, and then that's it. You can actually freeze blueberries unwashed. And they actually keep pretty well. Corn, it's better if you quickly pre-cook it for about a minute, flash cook it, and then put it in a freezer bag is good. High water content vegetables don't tend to do as well. Obviously, lettuce, for example, which won't keep at all.
Okay.
The other thing is butter. You know, we always call for unsalted butter because you don't know how much butter to add to the recipe. It's not a constant. Butter only keeps about 3 weeks in the refrigerator, tops.
So you want really to freeze butter.
Adrian and I always freeze butter, and the test kitchen always freezes it. As I said, on the door of the freezer is usually the best spot.
Hey, Chris, thank you.
My pleasure.
Chris Kimball is editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS. Now, he's got a classic American recipe for those frozen blueberries. Blueberry cobbler. It comes from the new best recipe book from the editors of Cook's Illustrated. Get the dish on the website, splendidtable.org. And once you've got that frozen fruit in the freezer, you could have a shot at my simple sorbet. You make it in 3 minutes. I call it Hungry Woman Simple Sorbet because it's faster and a bit more rustic than the usual kind. The other thing I love about it is that even lousy fruit works in this recipe. Now, I'm talking those frozen peaches from the supermarket. The key is knowing your flavor boosters. Now, for most fruit, they're almond extract, a little salt, sugar, and lemon juice. Now, here's the nut of the idea. You puree frozen fruit in the processor. Now, if it's bland, you add a little almond extract, some salt, sugar to taste, and a little lemon juice. And then you can pack it into teacups or wine glasses, maybe top it with some shavings of fresh ginger. Now, just remember, the more flavorful the fruit, the less extract and sugar you're going to need. And of course, you'll taste as you go. You can always add something. Now, I've got the recipe for Hungry Woman's Simple Sorbet on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, how to eat Korean, chef's secret techniques, and the wine bars of New York City. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, I've got this theory. When an immigrant group starts eating at its own restaurants, the food goes from being Americanized pap to the food they ate back home, and that's when you want to slip into a booth and feast. Now, for my money, Korean cuisine is the next darling of the trend trackers. It's not quite like any other Asian cooking. Now, food writer and artist Cecilia Hae-jin Lee has done a new book. It's called Eating Korean, From Barbecue to Kimchi, Recipes from My Home. Cecilia, welcome.
Thank you.
For me, I mean, I'm trying to get a grasp on how a Korean sees their own cuisine. What are the main elements? Because this really isn't like any other Asian cuisine I've tasted. It seems much bolder.
It's all about very strong flavors,
uh-huh.
like a lot of garlic. Like you don't find a Korean kitchen without garlic.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of chili paste and chili powder.
You know, it seems like there's a lot of beef on Korean menus. Is that sort of a mainstay in the cuisine?
Actually, no. You probably get that because beef and Korean barbecue is a restaurant food. But in regular eating, beef is very expensive in Korea and there aren't a lot of cows. So beef would be served to special guests. Like if you were a guest at someone's home, of course they're going to serve you beef.
Uh-huh.
If you go to a restaurant, it would be a special meal, so you're going to get beef. But generally, it's a lot about eating fish or eating vegetables and not about eating a lot of beef.
Uh-huh. How do you set up a Korean meal?
You always start with something like rice. That's the base of the meal.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure you have some kind of liquid like, you know, soup, a simple soup or like a water kimchi to wash it all down. And then you have all the small side dishes called banchan. And you have a main dish, like some kind of meat or a fish that's sort of the star of the meal.
Uh-huh.
And then it's all about balancing heat and cold and spicy and not spicy.
Does everything go out at once or is it served in courses?
It comes out all at once and most everything is shared. So it just all goes on the table and everyone digs in.
Is there a certain, I mean, for instance, I know in some cultures you want to eat a certain number of dishes or it always has to be an odd number of dishes. Does that hold true with Korean food?
It used to be in the old days, you have three dishes or five or seven or like a royal meal might have 12 or something like that, but not as much anymore. But odd numbers are lucky in Korean culture. So
do you use chopsticks to eat?
Yes, we always have a spoon and a chopstick and a pair of chopsticks. And the chopsticks are made out of metal, not like the wood ones you find in Chinese or Japanese restaurants. And they're slipperier and harder to use, actually.
But that's interesting. I don't think I've ever seen metal chopsticks.
Right. Yeah, only in Korean restaurants or Korean households. And the spoon is used for the soup and the rice, and the chopsticks is for everything else.
Now, when you order and you get those little side dishes you've mentioned, what are they?
You always get at least one or a couple of kimchis, so it just depends on the restaurant. And then lots of vegetables, maybe a sauteed spinach or like some sprouts or whatever, you know, happens to be in season.
Mm-hmm. You know, you keep mentioning kimchi, and I realize that I always think of kimchi as being a sort of very spicy, hot, maybe fermented cabbage. But you have 9 recipes for this in the book. How do you define kimchi?
Kimchi is sort of any kind of pickled vegetable that's, you know, it doesn't even have to be spicy. And I think the Korean, you know, Commission on Food or whatever says there's about 187 different kinds. So 9's nothing.
9's nothing.
Yeah.
Is it very regional?
Yes, it's very regional. Depending on where you are, different things go into the kimchi. Even the traditional one with the Napa cabbage that you're talking about, the spicy one, depending on what part of the peninsula you're on. It could be very salty. It could have different kinds of seafood in it. Some people put nuts in it and fruits in their kimchi even. So, yeah, it depends on where you are.
Well, Korean barbecue is probably a logical place for most of us Americans to begin playing with Korean flavors. Can you give us sort of a way that we can make our barbecue Korean?
Sure. I'll give you one recipe that is my family favorite, actually. It's the barbecued pork ribs called 돼지 갈비. Mm-hmm. And all you need to do is get, like, a lot of garlic, of course, and Korean chili paste, which comes in a jar that you can find in the stores or you could order it online, and sesame oil, some ginger, and soy sauce, and some sugar. And just mix it all up with your hands with the ribs and make sure it's well covered, marinated for at least half an hour overnight, and you just throw it on the grill and it's ready to go.
And that's it.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
Well, Cecilia, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Cecilia Hae-jin Lee writes about food for the LA Times and Korean Culture Magazine. Her book is Eating Korean, From Barbecue to Kimchi, Recipes from My Home. Now you can find Cecilia's recipe for those spicy pork ribs on the website, splendidtable.org. You want to know the fastest, slickest way to get a cooking job done? Go to the person who does it for a living, a chef, preferably a talented one. Well, that's what food writer Francine Maroukian did for her book. It's called Chef Secrets, Insider Techniques from Today's Culinary Masters. Hey, Francine, it's good to have you back.
Oh, and it's good to be here, Lynn. Thank you.
Now, Francine, you went after some of the biggest names in the business. Why would they want to tell you their secrets? I mean, that's stock and trade. That's how they make their living.
Oh, I mean, chefs love to talk about what they do. It's just that they don't get a chance to do that very often. People aren't really interested in the fundamentals of cooking in the kitchen. They're interested in the flashy stuff.
So you mean they really looked at you as though this is a woman who's serious, so I'm going to tell her the real story?
Well, interested. I mean, you know, serious, I don't know, but definitely interested. You know, I mean, they will open up for you if you ask them the right questions.
Mm-hmm. Were there any great surprises?
Well, not really, because I think that there was one that I'll tell you about in a moment, but I think for the most part that the chef's secrets sort of supported their kitchen philosophy. It revealed who they were in a way that it's sort of their kitchen signature. But there was one guy who I loved. I couldn't use him in the book because lawsuits were just waiting to happen, but he cooks chicken with a bottle rocket by inserting the bottle rocket and launching the chicken from a fence post. He says the hardest part of that is finding the chicken when it's done.
And that cooks the chicken?
He says that it does. I didn't try it. In New York, we don't have a lot of fence posts, so it would be hard for me to replicate. But he was very detailed about it, very serious about, well, very committed to his cooking technique.
I picture a restaurant way out in the country with periodic flares going up.
I just want to say one word to you, Texas.
Yeah. Okay. I got it. All
Lots
right.
of room for birds to fly out there, self-propelled.
Well, you know, I'm looking through the table of contents of the book, and there are some things that really caught my eye. Maybe you could tell us these secrets, okay? Mm-hmm. First one was how to make cappuccino at home.
Yeah, that's a really good one. And this secret really supports the corporate philosophy of these guys at La Colombe Coffee in Philadelphia. It reflects their attitude. They are very no fuss. Now, you know, these guys sell coffee to Alain Ducasse and Jean George and Danielle Ballou. I mean, they sell coffee to all the four-star restaurants in New York, but they are very laid back about what it is they do. And coffee's become so complicated and corporate that you have to, like, order it in a specific way. People are spending so much money on espresso machines, and they're like, stop the coffee madness. This is how you can make cappuccino at home. You don't need a big, expensive machine to steam your milk.
So what do they do?
Well, they use two French presses, you know, making the coffee in one and pumping the milk in the other until it doesn't really foam as much as rise.
Ah, okay. All right, the next one. How to achieve sand-free clams. And this is by Paul Wade.
Yes. Now, this is kind of interesting. There's a couple of secrets in the book. You know, there's a movement in the food business now towards what I call the laboratory of food. You know, it's very scientific.
Right.
And it's very deliberate, their investigations. This is just one of the things that happened. It may seem like science, but Paul didn't learn it in a scientific way. It's part of what he calls the mythology of the kitchen. Someone told him that if you put clams in water and you run water over the back of a spoon into that bowl, that it creates an electric charge, and the sand jumps out of the clam in response to that charge. It's an electrostatic discharge of charged particles. There's physics behind it, but not for him.
Uh-huh.
There's mythology behind it. He just learned it from someone in the kitchen.
And it works.
And it works.
Amazing. Wait, last one. Emily Lucchetti, the famous pastry chef,
yeah.
How to care for strawberries.
Well, see, again, her signature. This secret reflects her respect for the vulnerability, the perishability of fruit. She treats it so tenderly, you know, because bakers have something that chefs don't have. Bakers have, I call them the place kickers of the food business, because they have such a specific, such a refined skill. And that's, you know, that's expressed in her elaborate and delicate way that she treats such a delicate fruit.
So what does she do with it?
Oh, you know, I'm sorry. I was just going on about the psychology behind it because I just think it's so revealing. But yes, it's also very practical. She explains how the fruit shouldn't be hulled or cut before it's washed, that it shouldn't be rinsed under running water. And I have to say that I'm someone who does that, and now I don't do it anymore. I used to do it. She says that the fruit should be sort of swished in cool water so that the sand and the dirt falls to the bottom of the bowl. Then she doesn't store them stacked. She stores them flat on either a tray or a plate.
So they're never leaning against each other.
They're never leaning against each other, and she says that even though they are that way when you buy them, that you should turn the little green plastic strawberry cage upside down to make sure that the strawberries in the bottom aren't too bruised, because one can ruin an entire pint of strawberries.
Huh. Hey, you know, it's just the next level of making stuff work. Yeah, Francine, thank you.
Oh, certainly. Goodbye.
Food writer Francine Maroukian is contributing editor to Esquire magazine. Her latest book is Chef Secrets, Insider Techniques from Today's Culinary Masters. Mike Colomeco covers the New York City food scene on his PBS series, Colomeco's Food Show. He has an everyman's approach to the city, and he has something most reporters are missing. He's a former city chef, and he lives with a pastry chef, so he knows what goes on behind the stoves. Hey, Mike, it's good to have you back.
Hey, Lynn, always great to be here. Hi.
You know, Mike, I was thinking about the fact that the great bargain place to eat in a lot of cities is a wine bar. What's the wine bar scene like in New York?
It's absolutely blossomed. Years ago, way back when in the 80s, my wife and I, who, as you mentioned, is a pastry chef, always used to take our vacations in Europe. A lot of times they'd start in Paris. And back then there was a lot of these little wine bars just opening up around Paris where you could drink these little French wines and eat simple foods and wines you'd never see stateside. And we'd come home and think, why isn't anybody doing that here? Well, fast forward to today, and it's happened. If you pick up a New York Zagat, I think now there's over 30 wine bars in the city, all over town. And what they share is what you said. There's like this great intersection of two things happening. One is you can eat really wonderfully inexpensive, simple foods from the Italian, you know, panini and simple pastas and little pizzas and cheese courses to some of them have a French twist. And you could pair them with glasses of wine, and the price points, by and large, are single digits. So, A, you're getting a great cheap meal. And B, you're able to explore this world of wine that I think, you know, for most consumers, and even me, and I'm a food and wine guy, is hard to demystify.
Well, yeah, it's true. And also the price of a glass, very big difference than the price of a bottle. If you hate it, you know, you're not sitting there saying, I've just spent $40.
That's it. You're not committed to the balance of it.
So where do you like to go?
Well, we'll pick a couple of spots like I always do for you for people that might be staying in different places in town. On the Upper East Side, off 3rd Avenue, there's in the 80s, a place called Etats-Unis, the French name for the United States. And it has a bit of a French twist, but don't let that fool you. They have a restaurant across the street that serves the food for the wine bar. So this wine bar is this little hole in the wall where they can make things like guacamole and simple salads and cheese courses. Little more serious food. The guy runs across the street with a platter, and it's wonderful. And this has a bit of a French bend. I mean, they've got, I was there the other night. I had guacamole with a wonderful hard cider from Normandy that you almost never see. A beautiful Italian Prosecco that was completely dry with a real simple fish course. Just wonderful stuff. They open wine by the bottles, put corks in them. They don't have any kind of machinery. And any given day, there's about a dozen bottles open at a time, and they're all really interesting. On the other end of town, on the Lower East Side, is a place called Inoteca that comes from the Italian tradition, which is kind of where these wine bars got their start.
Mm-hmm.
Italian wine stores at one point began to serve food so people could taste wine. And what would you serve? You'd serve cheese, you'd serve hard salami. All these things work well to just develop the palate for the wine. Inoteca's got three menu really divisions. They've got pastas, they've got simple plates with cheeses and salads, and then these panini varieties that are these great, humble, grilled sandwiches with great interiors. I mean, really simple, fun grazing food that works super with the wine that they serve, which is really kind of an international blend. It's a downtown scene. It's at Rivington Street, so it's that sort of Lower East Side. You know, everyone's young and good-looking, and if you go there at midnight, you're liable to wait in line, but it's worth it. It's a super spot.
That's part of the city that's really opened up more recently, isn't it?
It's like, who would have thunk it? You know, 10 years ago, you should have shot a cannon across that street, and you might have hit a pigeon after 9 o'clock at night. Yeah, it has. That Clinton Street, Rivington, that Lower East Side's become a destination, but this is what New York does.
So where else?
There's a chain now that started. It's called Bar Veloce, and they started with one. I don't know which one was the first, but there's three or four of them now. Tiny little sleek storefronts. You know, these are all of 12 feet wide. You stand to the left, there's a little bar to the right, a couple tables in the back, very sleek, very modern, wonderful, again, this wonderful wine selections. That's why I like them. I mean, I like wine bars where the selections are really well thought out, they're international. And again, here you've got this great selection of wines, bartenders that know the stuff, and the simple foods to go with it, along with desserts, but really simple grilled sandwiches, the paninis. I had a Nutella Napoleon there the other day.
What about Midtown?
Well, the best bet is Rockefeller Center, the Morel Wine Bar, which sits right on Rock Center. It faces the tree when the tree's in season. It's a half a block in off the skating rink. You've got all that architecture around you. They have outside seating, and it sits adjacent to the Morel Wine Store, which is really a New York fixture. This is a second-generation business. They have the deepest selection. At any given time, they've got 50, 60 bottles of wine open, and everything from literally a half a dozen to a dozen champagnes to $6 or $7 selections to like a $55 a glass super Tuscan. And I would recommend this, too, because it can be two things. It can be a wine bar you're going to go to because you want to kick your feet up, enjoy the spring day. It's a beautiful place to sit. And again, you could eat for $5 or $6 a course and have simple glasses. Or I'll throw another one at you. Let's say it's an occasion. It's an anniversary. It's something big that you want to celebrate. Well,
right.
You can go there and eat this really, you know, diver scallops and duck confit and cats, these really developed dishes because they do have a very strong kitchen, and pair it with wines that you're never going to buy a bottle of. I mean, you might go in there and they'll have a 1961 Petrus open, or they had this Tuscan that I loved. It's $55 a glass. I'm not going to buy a bottle. But for an occasion, man, I could see going there and saying, let's look at this like it's a restaurant. We'll have a great champagne, a great starter wine, a great red wine, and maybe finish it off with an Armagnac. But we'll spend a few bucks, but boy, are we going to eat our way through. And Morel's is really special that way.
And then we can skip the mortgage payment. Hey, Mike, thank you.
Lynn, thank you as always. Take care.
Mike Colimeco covers the New York City food scene on his PBS 13 series, Colimeco's Food Show. Now, we've put Mike's wine bar picks right up on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the correct response if someone offers you Cullen Skink? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the correct response if someone offers you Cullen Skink? Well, the answer is grab a spoon. Cullen Skink is a soup. And it's a classic in Scotland, where soup is taken very seriously. The name may be a hard sell, but the recipe sounds good. Imagine smoky haddock, cooked with onions into a rich broth, and then milk goes in, and potatoes. Not bad. Let me break down the name. The soup comes from the fishing town of Cullen on the northeast coast of Scotland. Now, they've done smoke haddock there forever. Now, one of the meanings of the word skink is a beef broth. I'm wondering if Cullen called its soup skink because the smoked haddock was like the beef of this coastal town. I mean, grazing land looks pretty scarce there, but I'll bet everybody could get their hands on some haddock.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get to the phones. We have Melissa calling from Carbo, North Carolina. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You've got Melissa right. It's actually Carborough.
Carborough. Okay, because I thought Carbo sounds a little bit like anti-whatever diet, but
right.
Did you have a question, Melissa?
I do, and thank you for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
Enjoy your show. My question is in regard to a mystery ingredient. I have a recipe for a vegetable chili that calls for 2/3 cup of passata, and I don't know if I'm saying that correctly or not, but it's P-A-S-S-A-T-A. And despite searching high and low, I haven't been able to find even a definition for passata. So I'm curious to know what it is, where I might find it, and what else it might be good in.
Is the writer Italian by any chance?
Well, I don't think so, but I know that it's published out of the UK.
Ah, that may be the answer. It's passata, and I know it from Italian. Essentially what it means is a puree of tomatoes.
Okay.
And it would be, it might actually be that in the UK they're selling cans of pureed tomatoes and, you know, it says passata on the,
right.
And what it comes from, I always think of it anyway, as passed, meaning it's like been passed through a sieve.
Uh-huh.
You know, you've sieved it or whatever. So you can buy, I don't like tomato puree canned because often it's thickened with low grade tomato paste that has a metallic flavor.
Okay.
So what I would suggest is take whole canned tomatoes and just drop them in a food processor or a blender, and you've got passata, you know. And in fact, you could even crush them with your hands because they're going to cook in anyway.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't matter if they're, you know, not totally smooth.
Right.
But that's what it is.
Okay. Well,
that's very interesting, though. The UK would refer to it as that. This Italophile business really is getting carried away with itself.
Right.
Enjoy the chili, and thanks.
Thank you so much.
Goodbye. Bye-bye. You can call us at 800-537-5252. You know, I remember the great pioneer writing about the foods of the Mediterranean in the UK was Elizabeth David. And her books make fabulous reading. I mean, she goes back to the 50s and the 60s and I think even the early 70s. And she wrote like a dream. She really did. So if you have no interest in food, you'll just enjoy her writing. But it's a wonderful picture of what the UK was like back then. The idea that tomatoes in a can that had an Italian name would have been incredibly exotic. Olive oil was evidently very hard to find. And of course, you know, you have to remember too, especially in the 50s, that the UK probably suffered more after World War II than most of Europe did. They had food rationing and all kinds of things. But anyway, Elizabeth David, great read and an interesting portrait of a time when very few people knew about Italian food in the UK. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. Let's see, we have Steve on the line from Belleville. Hey, Steve, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn, how you doing?
I'm doing swell.
Great, yeah, I wanted to talk about rhubarb.
Ah, okay.
I was wondering how long you keep rhubarb in a freezer?
3 to 6 months. It does get mushy, you know, but you get all that flavor. And it's great because, you know, you always have to cook rhubarb. You can't eat it raw. It's quite dangerous to eat raw.
Okay.
So freezing is just going to break it down a bit, and then you can cook it a bit, and, it, you know, you can do anything you want with it.
Yeah.
You know, we were just in Italy, and there was something that we had there that's very popular and occurred to me that rhubarb may be a natural for this. It's like a conserve or a chutney. Follow me for a minute, okay?
Sure.
Cut up the rhubarb and toss it with sugar. Like, you know, if you have 2 cups of rhubarb, have about a cup or a cup and a half of sugar and put it in either a glass bowl or something that's not going to react. So you might put it in a glass bowl. You might put it in a plastic bowl or a stainless steel bowl and just forget about it overnight. Leave it out at room temperature.
Okay.
The sugar is going to start leaching the juices from the rhubarb. And what you can do then is drain the rhubarb, take that those juices, which are like a rhubarb sugar syrup, boil that down, drop in the rhubarb, and cook the rhubarb in that until it's cooked through, adding something spicy to it. In Italy, it would be mustard oil because you want something that almost clears your sinuses along with the sweetness. But if you can't get mustard oil, it's in Indian shops, but if you can't get that, I mean, you could throw chili into it. You could put Tabasco into it and cook that until the rhubarb is really, you know, nice and soft. And use it like a chutney. And I'm just thinking, wouldn't that be great, you know, on something like a ham sandwich?
Yeah.
You know, or a cheese sandwich with really, really sharp cheddar.
Wow, that sounds really good.
Yeah, and then you could stick it in the fridge and it probably would keep for, you know, a month,
yeah,
maybe longer.
Right.
Yeah. See how it works out.
Yeah, I'll try that.
And then give us a call and let us know.
Okay, will do, Lynn.
Steve, you're going to be the official recipe tester for the Splendid Table.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, thank you. Take care. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who's up next. We've got Amy calling from Los Angeles. Hey, Amy, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, first of all, Lynn, I want to thank you for Cecina. You did an interview with Jenna, who's the proprietor there.
Oh, yes.
And I happened to be driving by as I was listening to the interview on my radio.
Right.
And we actually ended up getting our wedding cake from her. She was just wonderful.
Oh, that's great.
And the cake was incredible.
That's super. That's super. Did you have a question?
Yeah. I'm actually calling because we went on our honeymoon to Florence.
Uh-huh.
And my wife has been bugging me ever since we got back to call you and find out how we can get some bread like the bread we had. We've been trying to recreate the paninis we had there.
Oh, yeah. Describe to me what, because paninis change very slightly from one place to another.
Well, we just got them at snack shops and,
right,
you know, these little places where you can get everything from an espresso to a beer to an ice cream,
right,
to a,
right,
sandwich.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they would heat them up. And the ones I, you know, we would have a prosciutto cotto.
Right.
And,
which is boiled ham, what we would call boiled ham.
Yeah.
Right.
And then I think it was a fontina cheese.
Uh-huh.
And then it had this bread. And that is the one thing, you know, we can find a reasonable ham and a reasonable fontina, you know, close to what we had there.
Right.
But we just can't seem to find the bread. And it was crispy, but not too, you know, not hard.
Right, right. Okay, I think, now, by the way, if you really are ambitious, there is the best book ever written on making Italian breads. It's by Carol Field, and it's called The Italian Baker. And if you feel ambitious and you feel like making bread, there is no better book out there. The research is just primo and the recipes work like a charm. But what I'm thinking of is that often the bread is these small white rolls and it's a white bread that does not have any sugar in it. And I would say that if you, I'm just trying to think, if you could get an Italian bread, not a baguette, not that style, but what would be close would be something that might be called an Italian country bread, but it's made out of white flour. Okay, something chewy. If you do you live near the Campanile Bakery by any chance? It's right there in L.A.
Is it? Well, then I do.
Yeah. Well, I know L.A. is pretty big. But they do one of their Italian or French breads that are like a country loaf would come pretty close to this. And it's tricky because it's this really interesting combination. You're right. It's not really, it's kind of crisp, but it's not a chewy, chewy, heavy bread.
Yeah.
Right? There's a sort of lightness to it.
Yeah, exactly.
And that bread is going to you're going to have to test until you find it. I think Campanile may be a good place to look. Anybody that's doing artisan breads, you want it white, you want it to be called country loaf. And I'd see what you come up with. Those little rolls are hard to find because generally it's those little rolls.
Right. No, that's what it was. It was those little sandwich-sized rolls.
Right. And they're never sourdough. They are very neutral in flavor. Because the whole idea is the center. And do you have any problem doing them in the pan, you know, heating them up?
No, we've done okay with that.
Okay, because there's a trick where you just put them in a skillet, cover them with foil, and stick a cake pan with cans in it to press it. And then you just do that on both sides and you've got a panini.
Oh, we'll have to try that.
Yeah, I wish I could give you the name of a specific bread, but it varies too much. You got to test out, but it's going to be artisan made, it's going to be white, and it's going to be country.
Well, I know my wife won't mind testing it out.
she's a woman after my own heart. Hey, Amy, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Want to make thousands of bucks partying? Well, all you need is a bowl that burps. Now, that was the magic that started in the 1950s, and it's still going strong around the world. Now, I am talking Tupperware parties, a.k.a. women making careers without leaving home. Now, Tupperware is the name of the PBS special on the American experience. In fact, it won a Peabody Award this year. Now, we have Tupperware's producer, director, and writer on the line, Lori Kahn-Levitt. Lori, welcome.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Lori, what was the draw of Tupperware?
Well, I'm interested in telling stories that no one else is telling, and I'm drawn to stories about women in particular, and stories about history seen not from the top down, you know, not the stories of presidents and wars and disasters, but the stories of ordinary people. And here was this story with unbelievable footage. I mean, it's just delicious, you know, these home movies and Tupperware Jubilee films and the company's own films of Tupperware parties, and it's just wild and crazy stuff. But it's also the story of these working class women who had dead-end lives back in the 1950s after World War II, who were being told by the culture to go back to the kitchen, but they needed money.
Right.
And here was an opportunity for them to earn extra money that they needed, and they could control their own hours, and they could work as much or as little as they wanted. And it helped them buy houses and cars and refrigerators and whatever it was that they needed.
Now, this something was this idea of selling Tupperware by home parties, right?
Exactly.
Now, who came up with this idea?
Well, the idea for Tupperware came from this woman named Brownie Wise. The Tupperware, the product, was invented by a guy named Earl Silas Tupper, who was a self-taught inventor tinkerer who fancied himself to be a kind of, you know, Ford or Edison, which he really wasn't. But, I mean, he created all kinds of wacko products. But he did invent this really good Wonder Bowl with its now famous burping seal. But he didn't know how to market it. And it was this woman named Brownie Wise, who never got past eighth grade, grew up dirt poor in rural Georgia. And she had been selling Stanley home products. They were the first ones to do home parties. And she saw Tupperware languishing on a shelf in a department store in Detroit. And she thought, wow, this stuff is really kind of interesting, but it needs to be demonstrated at a party so people know how to use it. And she started selling it at home parties, and it was really successful. And she was a really good marketing person, very intuitive marketing person. And she started her own little company selling Tupperware at home parties and was phenomenally successful. And one day she calls up the factory to complain that her order is late yet again.
Yeah.
And she insists on speaking to Mr. Tupper himself, gets him on the phone, and chews him out. And he says, what are you doing? I mean, like, you are selling more than all the department stores. And she says, home parties. You should only sell this stuff at home parties. Take it out of the department stores. Take it out of the hardware stores. And he listened to her, which is incredible because he hardly ever listened to anybody. And he made her in charge, put her in charge of all of the sales operations for the company. And she built an empire for him.
So did Brownie end up rolling in money coming out of all of this?
One wishes she had. But no, not at all. She got screwed.
Really?
She and Earl Tupper, you know, they both came from poor backgrounds with huge ambitions, but couldn't see that they needed each other. And he ends up firing her after 7.5 years together, and nobody in the company sees it coming. What's incredible is that he never succeeds again. I mean, he ends up selling the company, so he ends up with money because he owns all the stock.
Right.
But he never succeeds again. He keeps inventing things, but he never succeeds again. She never succeeds again. She starts a whole string of home party companies, and none of them succeed again. But the women who she's empowered, all of these working-class women, and I interviewed about 300 of them for the film, they discover that they can carry on without her. I mean, she's taught them enough that they really can do it on their own.
Mm.
And a lot of those people retired with millions.
An incredible story. Well, Lori Conn-Levitt, congratulations on the Peabody, and thank you.
Thank you so much, too.
Lori Conn-Levitt is producer, director, and writer of Tupperware, featured on PBS's American Experience. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. Now, until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Matt Lauer. He said, researchers have discovered that chocolate produces some of the same reactions in the brain as marijuana. The researchers also discovered other similarities between the two, but can't remember what they are. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lukey. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.